I'm going to try and talk about the evolution of the grand jury. What is the grand jury? What are people's rights vis-a-vis the grand jury? What's a subpoena? How the legal system operates vis-a-vis the grand jury? Because people, I mean, I know people don't really understand what it means to be called before a grand jury. What are your rights? What happens? First of all, the grand jury comes from the English common law. And the idea of as it evolved in England was is that a group of citizens were supposed to stand between the government and a potentially a person that's accused and decide whether or not the government has sufficient evidence to charge them with a crime. So it was essentially a protection for the individual. If there was a persecution by a government official or by government prosecutor, people from that person's community would hear the evidence against them, and if they felt that the evidence wasn't sufficient, the person wouldn't be charged with a crime. So when that idea was brought over to the United States, it was actually put into the Bill of Rights. And Amendment 6, the Sixth Amendment to the Bill of Rights, says you cannot be charged with a felony crime, a serious crime, unless there's a grand jury presentment or indictment. So in order for everyone that's charged with a felony in federal court in the United States, a grand jury has to return an indictment. And essentially, the theory is the grand jury saying there's probable cause to believe that a crime was committed and that the person charged with the indictment has to respond to that and stand trial, which sounds like a very good thing, and that would seem to be a protection. And I would assume the framers of the Constitution, when they put it in there, were thinking, wow, we're going to use this, and this is going to protect our citizens from overzealous prosecutors. What basically has happened in the history of our country, and if you look at every stage of our history, the grand jury has essentially always acted in the interest of the government or in the majority population. So, for example, when the Federalists were in power right after the Revolution, the grand jury attacked the Jefferson Republicans, and there were all kinds of indictments against the Jefferson Republicans, and there was the Alien and Sedition Laws, which said that the Jefferson Republicans were too close to the French, and they were trying to overthrow the government. So there was a series of grand jury indictments against the Jeffersonian Republicans. When the Jeffersonian Republicans got into power, they used the grand jury to indict the Federalists, and there was a whole series of indictments against the Federalists. And then you can go to the period before the Civil War. The grand juries in the South would go after people who were opposing slavery. They would indict newspapers from the North that were anti-slavery and were going into the South. And in the North, there wasn't much grand jury activity around slavery. In a few cases, the grand jury refused to indict people who were harboring runaway slaves. So again, you see the grand jury really was responding to the majority sentiment. It wasn't a protection against the individuals. During the labor movement, there were hundreds of indictments against the IWW, against Eugene Debs, against the labor leaders, and these were all grand jury indictments. In Chicago alone, there was a grand jury indictment that charged 100 members of the IWW, including Big Bill Haywood, to stand trial. And again, these grand jurors were beholden to the government, essentially. After World War II, you saw an explosion of criminal federal laws, the urbanization of America, and then the use of the Commerce Clause to make all kinds of laws of criminal nature. So you began to see that hundreds of indictments were going to be returned by grand juries, and there was no possible way, even though if you look through the history of the U.S. up to then, there may have been one or two or three or four cases in which the grand jury said, no, we're not going to indict. But after World War II, the grand jury essentially became a rubber stamp of the government because grand jurors were hearing cases, several hundred cases a week, and they would be called, they were citizens, they had no idea They were beholden to the prosecutor to call which witnesses before them, to argue what the law was, and essentially grand juries became a rubber stamp. And this is written extensively. The former head of the New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court of New York, has very famously said a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if the government wanted them to. So we see that the grand jury really became an appendage of the government. They needed to do it because they couldn't return an indictment without it, but the grand jurors were not acting independently of the government in any case. But then what happened was in the 1950s and through the 50s into the 60s, we began to see the use of government agencies to investigate people on the left, the Communist Party, people associated with the Communist Party, people sympathetic to civil rights and civil liberties. And, of course, many people are aware of the Senate Committee on House American Activities and the Congress. House of Representatives had a committee, the Senate had a committee, and these were investigative bodies who were calling people to before them to learn about other people's political activities and their own political activities. But there was also the grand jury, and the grand jury was doing the same thing. They were not looking at a crime and calling the witnesses to the crime and saying, okay, let's see if there's enough evidence to charge you with a crime. They became investigative bodies of the U.S. government. They're called investigative grand juries. So rather than calling witnesses to a crime, they were trying to gather information about political activities. And what happened was is that they passed a law in the 1950s called the Immunity Law, which basically said if you're called before a grand jury and given immunity, which means that at that time what you say and what they're investigating can't be used against you, your Fifth Amendment right not to self-incriminate yourself would be wiped away. So in other words, what they established for the first time was that somebody is called before a grand jury, it's an investigative grand jury, you're not a witness to a crime, and therefore they want to find out whether there's enough evidence to charge this person with a crime. But now they're trying to gather information. And what they say now is that if you're called before a grand jury, the government can, usually if you're called before a grand jury, you say, well, I'm not going to testify, and people, of course, in the 50s raised that in relation to these congressional investigative committees, but the grand jury as well. I'm not going to testify because what I may say might incriminate me. And the idea of what may incriminate you is very broad. That means it may incriminate me for a crime, or it may expose my political relationships or my political views or my right of privacy. So I have the right under the Fifth Amendment not to incriminate myself, and that would end it. But now what happened then was the government says, oh no, we're going to give you immunity. So what you say in the grand jury will not be used against you, and therefore it can't be used against you to prosecute you for a crime, and therefore you're going to have to go in there and answer all our questions. All our questions, not just the ones you want to answer. So what happened then is, and actually in the 50s they didn't use the grand jury that extensively, but that power was established now, the right to call people before the grand jury and give them immunity. In addition, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision in the 50s said that the right of self-incrimination only applies to criminal a concern about being charged with a crime. No longer did you say, well, my right of self-incrimination means what political organizations I belong to, what where I travel, what my neighbors are doing, what my friends are doing. No. The Supreme Court said the only right of self-incrimination has to do with whether or not what you say will cause you to be charged with a crime. So they narrowed the right of self-incrimination. They now gave you an immunity, which took away even your Fifth Amendment right, and it exploded. By the time the Nixon era began, there was an internal division of the Justice Department, and by 1970, and maybe people don't remember this, but there were 100 people subpoenaed to grand juries in 80 different cities. and they were investigating people who were active in the anti-Vietnam War movement. And they were all the people on the Catholic left, women's groups, black groups, Puerto Rican groups, all kinds of groups were subpoenaed, members of those groups were subpoenaed to the grand jury. The Supreme Court also did another thing right about that time. It used to be that the immunity was called transactional immunity. So, for example, if you went before the grand jury, and this is not the situation here, but and they asked you about a bank robbery, and you testified with immunity, they could never charge you with the bank robbery. That was called the transaction you testified about, you have total immunity. The Supreme Court narrowed that in the early 70s, and it said that the immunity only is use immunity, which means that only your words cannot be used against you when you get immunity and go and testify in the grand jury. They can still charge you with the bank robbery, for example, but they can't use what you say in the grand jury. So you're forced to go before the grand jury. You give them information, and they say, oh, well, we're not using what you say, but now they know you're involved in it, so they can charge you with that crime. So your right of self-incrimination is basically eviscerated. And I want to read to you to show you what this means, because once you go in that grand jury and once you're given immunity, you have to answer every question they ask. And the First Amendment does not apply in the grand jury context. You cannot say, oh, you're asking me about my religious beliefs or my political beliefs or my associations with everybody. That's not proper. Or you're invading my right of privacy. The theory is the grand jury is entitled to every, quote unquote, every man's evidence. And therefore, you cannot say to the prosecutor, oh, you can't ask me that question. I'm not going to answer that question because that's an invasion of my First Amendment rights or my rights of association. The other thing you should know is that when you go in front of a grand jury, you don't have a lawyer. The lawyer cannot go in the room with you. There is no judge in the room. It's essentially 23 people who sit there as grand jurors and the prosecutor. And the prosecutor asks you the questions. And I guess if you don't want to answer the question, you could say, I'm not going to answer that question. But if you don't answer the question, once you've been given immunity, you can be held in contempt. And there's two types of contempt. There's civil contempt, which the theory is that you hold the keys to your freedom. Once you talk to them or answer the questions they want you to answer, you can be let out of prison. But if you refuse to on political, moral beliefs, you can be kept in prison for the life of the grand jury, which is up to 18 months. And sometimes, once that grand jury's life is expired, they can reinstitute the grand jury and put you in for another 18 months. So you can be put in jail without being charged with a crime, without being put on trial, simply for not answering all the questions they ask you, up to 36 months. But it gets worse. There's also what's called criminal contempt, which is the same act of refusing to testify, could be a civil disobedience and put you in there, or it could be considered a crime. And you can be put in jail for the civil disobedience, and then once you serve that time, after a few months, they can indict you for criminal contempt. It's a crime. Believe it or not, there is no maximum penalty for criminal contempt. In other words, theoretically, you could get life in prison for that nonviolent act of civil disobedience. Now, you might say, well, you're being hyperbolic, no one's going to get life in prison, and it's true. I've never seen anyone get life in prison. But I am representing a Palestinian man who was charged with providing monies for people in the West Bank. He was charged with a very serious charge of being part of a racketeering organization because of that, and refusing to testify in the grand jury. He was acquitted of the serious charge. The jury didn't believe he was involved in it. But, of course, he did not testify in the grand jury. And he had gone to jail in civil contempt for 6 months. While he was in jail for 6 months, they indicted him for the serious charge and the criminal contempt. He was convicted of the criminal contempt because the only issue was whether he testified or not. And because the grand jury was investigating funding of groups in the Palestinian groups, which they considered terrorists, He was considered aiding and abetting terrorists, and when the judge sentenced them, she gave him 11 and a half years in prison for that act of not testifying in the grand jury. So this is very serious type of crime, even though it seems to many of us that it's just expressing your rights, political rights, to remain silent and not give information about your friends or your neighbors. I just want to read you a sample question that was asked of somebody subpoenaed to the grand jury back in the Nixon days. And this, make no mistake about it, what's happening now is not any different than what they did in the Nixon days. They're targeting people who are politically active. They want them to provide information about their associations and their views. And if they give them immunity, then these are the type of questions they'll be asked. Tell the grand jury every place you went after you returned to your apartment from Cuba, every city you visited, with whom and by what means of transportation you traveled, and who you visited at all of the places you went during the times of your travels after you left your apartment in Ann Arbor, Michigan in May of 1970. I want you to describe for the grand jury every occasion during the year 1970 when you had been in contact with, attended meetings which were conducted by, or attended by, or been any place when any individual spoke whom you knew to be associated with or affiliated with the Students for a Democratic Society, the Weathermen, the Communist Party, or any other organization advocating revolutionary overthrow of the United States, describing for the grand jury when these incidents occurred, where they occurred, who was present, and what was said by all persons there, and what you did at the time that you were in those meetings, groups, associations, or conversations. So that's the type of scope that the grand jury can be asking people.
What's the next question?
What?
What's the next question?
Oh, yeah, what's the next question? Yeah. And that's why, beginning in that late 60s, early 70s, there developed what's called a position of non-collaboration with grand juries. People who were subpoenaed, who were political activists, said, no, we're not going to go before the grand jury. You can give us immunity. You can threaten us with jail. But we're not going to be parties to this type of political repression. And we're not going to cooperate with this type of government fishing expedition. And some people went to jail. And some people resisted and didn't go to jail because they backed off. And that has happened, perpetuated, through up to the present day. In the early 1980s, I represented people from the Puerto Rican community of Chicago, many of them who were activists in support of independence for Puerto Rico. And of course, as we know, or maybe you remember, there was a group called the FALN that took responsibility for acts of bombings and other acts, violent acts, in the name of Puerto Rican independence. And some of these people were relatives of people who were subpoenaed to the grand jury. The people who they thought were members of the FALN had come out of that community, of the Westtown community of Chicago, and they went after their family members, they went after their former comrades in the independence movement, and tens of people were subpoenaed to grand jury. They even subpoenaed people from the Hispanic Affairs Commission of the Episcopal Church, because apparently the Episcopal Church had a Hispanic Affairs Commission, and one of those members of that commission turned out to be involved with the FALN. They subpoenaed the secretary of the Hispanic Affairs Commission, a woman by the name of Maria Cueto, and others, and even Chicano activists from the southwest part of the U.S. And many of those people went to prison, refusing to testify, and then some of them actually got out and were subpoenaed again, and they got charged with criminal contempt, and they were put on trial in a federal court in Brooklyn, and they were sentenced to 3 years in prison. And that was back in 1981, 1982. So this is an issue that the government uses to attack political activists and to create this kind of chilling effect on people who are involved in going and finding out about what's going on in the Middle East or other places in the world and being active in political activity. They use it as a way to investigate and to gather political information, and they do it with that power to coerce people and force them to testify. So this is the situation we face for these 23 people. Now, what has happened up to now is the government has not moved to give anyone immunity. We don't know what they're going to do, but once they give someone immunity, that means they either testify along the lines that I've discussed with you, or they go to jail. And it's a very difficult decision, as you can imagine, for somebody who is not involved in any criminal activity, who is just doing political work, but doesn't want to become an informant for the government, doesn't want to give information about their people they're working in a political group with. They don't even know what the information they're after exactly. And the government doesn't tell you what information they're after. Now, there is a legal procedure where you can go in front of a judge and move to quash the subpoena, saying the subpoena is the product of illegal activity. It never works. It hasn't worked in 30, 40 years. Very few subpoenas that are ever quashed. I would add to you, also tell you that organizations' records can be subpoenaed to a grand jury. And in this case, a group called the Arab American Action Committee, AAAN, Action Network, which is a group that does tremendous work in the Arab communities on the southwest side of Chicago. All their files and documents have been subpoenaed by a grand jury. In addition, there's two anti-war groups in Minnesota that had organized against the Republican Convention in 2008. Their records have been subpoenaed by the grand jury. And in fact, you don't even have any Fifth Amendment rights as to the records. They get the records. There's no way to really challenge that in a successful way. So the grand jury power, once it's in the hands of the U.S. attorney, is a tremendous power. What often happens is the FBI, who does not have a subpoena power, they're never given a subpoena power. They've asked for it many times, and the Congress has refused it. Well, what they do is they knock on your door, and they say, I want to talk to you about your travel or your political work. And if you say, well, I don't have to talk to you, and you don't have to talk to the FBI. If you talk to the FBI and lie to them, that's a crime. But you don't have to talk to the FBI. What the FBI says to you is, if you don't talk to me, I'm going to see that you get subpoenaed to a grand jury. They don't have that power, but they have the U.S. attorney who works with them. Theoretically, it's not even the U.S. attorney's power. It's the grand jury's power. But the grand jury doesn't decide who's subpoenaed. They don't decide what documents are subpoenaed. They don't have any idea what's going on, really. They're there just to be a facade, to be used by the U.S. attorney to go after political activists in this case. So this is a situation that these people are facing now, and it's a very serious situation, and it's an abuse of the Constitution, in my view. And think about it. They can actually, and I've written an article if people are interested, it's called The Improper Use of the Federal Grand Jury, an Instrument for the Internment of Political Activists. And my thesis is that if they think you're part of an organization that they don't like or they think is involved in something that they think violates the law, they can, and they know that you're, based on your political principles, you're not going to cooperate with a grand jury, they can subpoena you to a grand jury, give you immunity. If you don't testify, they can put you in prison. And I analogize this to the internment power that they had in Northern Ireland to people who are suspected of being members of the IRA. In Northern Ireland, they suspected you were a member of the IRA, but they couldn't prove it in a court of law, so they interned you anyway, and they had a procedure for doing it. Well, the grand jury is internment American style, and that's the thesis of my article, and that's basically what I'm telling you today. Thank you very much.
Once again, just hold your questions until after our third speaker, and then we'll take questions from the floor. But now Mr. Meyer is going to talk about what is actually happening now with the current case.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about this case called Holder versus Humanitarian Law Projects. And this case has to do with the idea of material support for foreign terrorist organizations, which is what this grand jury in Chicago is investigating. This case was decided recently. It was decided in June of last year, June 21st of 2010. It was a 6-3 decision. Justice Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, wrote the opinion. And I wonder if anyone can guess who the government attorney was who argued this case. That's right, Elena Kagan, the newest Supreme Court justice, who was then Obama's Secretary General.
Solicitor General.
Oh, Solicitor General, yeah, excuse me. So, like I said, the issue in this case, there is a group called the Humanitarian Law Project, and what they wanted to do is they wanted to work with the PKK, which is the acronym for the Kurdistan Workers' Party, and the Tamil Tigers, which is the acronym is LTTE. And so there's a whole list of things they wanted to do, and I'm just going to kind of read them off for you. They wanted to train members of the PKK on how to use humanitarian and international law to peacefully resolve disputes. They wanted to engage in political advocacy on behalf of the Kurds who live in Turkey. Now, to explain, the PKK is kind of a Kurdish separatist group in Turkey, and so they're trying to advocate for the rights of the Kurds in Turkey who are a repressed minority. There's a lot of repression that goes on by the Turkish government against the Kurds. Okay, and so the third thing they wanted to do was to teach PKK members how to... Okay. They want to teach PKK members how to petition various representative bodies, such as the UN, for relief. They wanted to train... So now we're going to talk about the Tamil Tigers. They wanted to train the Tamil Tigers... or the LTTE, to present claims for tsunami relief to related aid mediators and international bodies. Because, you know, the tsunami that happened in, you know, the South Pacific several years ago hit Sri Lanka pretty hard. And so they wanted to help the Tamil Tigers help people get relief who were affected by the tsunami. And then another thing they wanted to do, they wanted to offer their legal expertise and negotiating peace agreements between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tigers. And the last thing they wanted to do was engage in political advocacy on behalf of Tamils in Sri Lanka. Now, as this case progressed, what happened was the Tamil Tigers were defeated by the Sri Lankan government. So a lot of these claims related to the Tamil Tigers are kind of moot at the point in time which the decision was made last June. But the Humanitarian Law Project still wanted to support the LTTE as an organization outside Sri Lanka that was advocating for the rights of Tamils. So like I said, this decision is about material support for foreign terrorist organizations. Now, what does that mean? Well, I want to say that it was created in 1996. The idea of material support was created in 1996 by the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 96. The definition has been modified by the Patriot Act, which, as you guys know, passed in 2001, and another bill called the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act in 2004. So what does the material support statute say? Well, it says that whoever knowingly provides material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization or attempts or conspires to do so can be imprisoned or fined. Standard imprisonment term is 15 years, but if someone's killed in relation to this provision of material support, it can be up to life. And so, what does material support mean? That definition doesn't really explain it. So there's another section of the U.S. Code that explains material support. And it says, the term material support and resources means any property, tangible or intangible, or service, and then it lists a bunch of financial services, et cetera. But services also includes lodging, training, also expert advice or assistance, providing the false documentation or a fake ID, or providing personnel to the organization. And so there's a long laundry list of things that are included in the material support definition. They weren't all challenged in this court case, but the ones I just described were. So there's the exception to this material support prohibition is that you can provide medicine, or religious materials to a foreign terrorist organization, and that is not illegal under the law as it stands. And so let's go back to this, the six things that I just talked about that the Humanitarian Law Project wants to do. They sound like, you know, legitimate things. We want people to be able to advocate on behalf of oppressed minority communities and help organizations use international law and petition the UN. These are peaceful activities that I think most of us would agree are something that, you know, are good things for the most part. And so the Roberts Court says that actually these things run afoul of the material support law, so you can't do them under the law. If you are, and they use very specific language, if they're performed in coordination with or at the direction of a foreign terrorist organization. And this includes the political advocacy on behalf of the Kurds and the Tamils that I talked about. If you're advocating in coordination with a foreign terrorist organization, you are doing something illegal under the material support law. Now, what's interesting is, you know, it's pretty easy to understand what at the direction of means, you know, like they tell you to do it or something. But, you know, we don't really know what in coordination with a foreign terrorist organization means. And this actually came up during the oral argument before the Supreme Court when it was argued in February of last year. And Justice Scalia said, you know, he said, in terms of coordination, we can decide that what that term means in the next case. So ostensibly, the Supreme Court didn't decide what coordination means with a foreign terrorist organization, and, you know, we're just kind of waiting to see. You know, it could mean a lot of things, right? So that's kind of still up in the air. As to the 6 points that I brought up earlier, the court says in regard to tsunami aid, that's not allowed because you can't help the Tamil Tigers get tsunami aid because, you know, money is fungible, and any money provided for, like, charity activities could just be converted and used for terrorist activities. So you can't ever help a terrorist, an organization on this terrorist list get money because that's material support because they might use it to buy guns or something. The idea behind their overall prohibition on the six things is that, you know, there's this idea that foreign terrorist organizations are so tainted by their criminal conduct that any contribution to such an organization facilitates that conduct, which, you know, that's a really interesting idea. You know, it would seem that you're not, I don't know, you can come to your own conclusions about what that might mean. But I wanted to read to you another part of the decision, which is in response to the Humanitarian Law Project's request to teach the Kurdistan Workers' Party about international law. And the court's response to this is that they can't do it. And they say that, and this is the language of Justice Roberts, it is wholly foreseeable that the PKK could use the specific skills, the training in international law, that the plaintiffs proposed to impart as a part of a broader strategy to promote terrorism. The PKK could, for example, pursue peaceful negotiation as a means of buying time to recover from short-term setbacks, lulling opponents into complacency, and ultimately preparing for renewed attacks. And then he goes on to say, this possibility is real and not remote. Now, I don't know what you guys think about that, but, you know, that seems a little little far afield. I don't know of anyone using international law as a means to further. Well, okay, but you know, I'm not sure it's you know, the court is on point here with the idea that, you know, the Kurdistan Workers Party is going to use this to plan further attacks. That sounds a little bit conspiratorial to me at best. And then, you know, the way they addressed the idea that the Humanitarian Law Project would help the PKK petition the UN, they said, well, that's not allowed, and that's not allowed for the same reasons tsunami aid isn't allowed, and that's because they could be petitioning the UN asking for money. So I guess we have to think about what this means in our context. There are lots of hypotheticals out there about what that means in regard to the First Amendment. This was a First Amendment case. The Humanitarian Law Project brought this case because they said the statute infringes on our First Amendment rights, and what we're proposing to engage in is protected First Amendment activity. And so in that light, I brought my handy-dandy little Constitution and Declaration of Independence, which, you know, every freedom-loving American should be carrying around in their pocket, right? So I just wanted to briefly read some of the First Amendment, and, you know, I think most people know what it says, but I think it's kind of relevant. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, I think what the Humanitarian Law Project was doing sounds a lot like petitioning a government for the redress of grievances. And it also sounds like a lot like associating, you know, there's the association aspect here with we're going to work with these organizations. And I think it's concerning that these types of associations and these forms of petition have been outlawed by the Congress, which arguably under the First Amendment they're not allowed to do. The lawyer for the Humanitarian Law Project was David Cole. And in his oral argument, he presented a couple of hypotheticals. And one of them was that, a couple of years ago, Hamas published an op-ed in the New York Times and the LA Times and the Washington Post. And it was a political op-ed that talked about the realities of the Palestinian struggle and the realities people on the ground were facing. And so David Cole said, well, if you find that coordination with a foreign terrorist organization is a material support, wouldn't you have to find that what the LA Times and the Washington Post did was illegal? Because arguably they had to coordinate with Hamas to get the article in their newspaper. And like I said, we talked about advocacy. If you're advocating, even advocacy and coordination is material support. And so he also points out that, former President Carter met with Hamas during his trip to the occupied territories. And then so does that mean that he had worked in coordination with a foreign terrorist organization too? We don't know. There's also this idea that lawyers write amicus briefs for courts. And there were a lot of amicus briefs that were written in this case, actually. Amicus briefs, it's a friend of the court brief. So outside organizations who have political interests in the case will write briefs in support of one side or the other. And so, you know, he brought up the idea like, well, what if a lawyer were hired by a foreign terrorist organization to write an amicus brief on a point of law that the organization felt was relevant? So maybe it's a First Amendment case, but, you know, like the Basque separatist movement, the ETA, wants you to write a brief on it because they feel like their interests are implicated. Well, if you write a brief on behalf of the ETA, you've provided material support. You've worked directly in coordination with them to produce this legal brief. So you can see how this impacts the legal field. It's the bounds of this are just so undefined. It could impact so many different things. I think you all know that President Obama has been a very vocal supporter of the anti-apartheid struggle. And I think arguably the ANC, had there been a foreign terrorist list on the books when it was around and doing stuff against apartheid, it probably would have been on our foreign terrorist list. And, you know, if this material support law was in place, it was.
Well, there wasn't in 96 when the law was passed, the ANC had already basically taken power. But if there were a list, they were considered a terrorist group back when Mandela was in prison in the 80s. So it's true, but they didn't really have that law until 96.
Right. So if this law had been in place, Obama could have been indicted under this law. So, like I said, I think that this case presents some very serious constitutional concerns regarding our First Amendment rights, and I think that's something that we all need to think very carefully about as this you know, as we go forward.
I just want to add a couple of quick points. First of all, the lower courts found that the nonviolent advocacy for these groups was protected by the First Amendment. That decision was appealed by the Obama administration. So not only did Elena Kagan, because she was Solicitor General, had that obligation to argue it, but it was pushed by the Obama administration to the Roberts Court. Secondly, that was a pre-enforcement challenge, which means that there weren't people charged with a crime who were then had to defend themselves. But so it was before the law was enforced as to them. They were trying to get a ruling. Now once that law is decided, if you're charged with providing material support for an organization, let's say a Palestinian organization, you cannot go into court now as a criminal defendant and say, oh, they're not a terrorist organization or whatever they are, they don't affect U.S. policy. I mean, we don't see a lot of terrorism activity by Palestinian organizations in the U.S. or any, you know, many of these groups have nothing to do with the U.S., but what they say is that they affect our economic and foreign policy, which gives the government a very broad scope as to who to put on that list. The determination of who goes on that list is done ex parte, which means in secret. They can consider the Secretary of State, it's done by the Secretary of State's office, they can consider any evidence submitted to them, newspaper accounts or testimony, but you can't go in there and have a hearing and challenge it. Once it's on there, there's a limited right of appeal, but you have to come forward and say, I'm a member of this terrorist group that you put on the list and I want to appeal it. If it's once it's put on the list and upheld on appeal, if there is an appeal, that's the end of it. You can't go in as a criminal defendant and say you're charging with supporting this group, and first of all, the group is not a terrorist group. You can't do that. It's already decided. So it really limits your ability to defend yourself, and of course, as Ben said, you face 15 years if you're convicted of that statute.
Thank you very much, all for your